good evening and welcome, friends, once again to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show is called Let the Way Be Open by a wonderful artist by the name of Abigail Spinner McBride, and she's out of Las Vegas. Thanks, Abigail, for the honor of playing your sacred music on the show. And thanks to you, too, my listeners out there, who have once again broken our record for listens and downloads. Our last show on instant healing and sex and the intelligence of the heart really went a long way to making that happen. So thanks to Julie McIntyre and Susan Shumsky, my guests, for your insights. And my thanks again to you, my listeners. You are all gas in my tank, and you keep me going. That said, if you don't mind, I'm going to take this opportunity to remind listeners or tell my new listeners that I pay out of my pocket for the airtime here on Blog Talk. It's not free like it used to be a long time ago. So if you want to help keep the show on the air, donations are most welcome in any amount. You can go to my website, KarenTate.com. When you're there, click on the Goddess Store page where I have my books and goddess greeting cards and free meditations and Sacred Places CDs for sale, and use one of the PayPal buttons to make a donation. Remember what Mother Nature teaches us, what we tend to and nurture, well, it thrives, and what we neglect withers on the vine. Also, check out the special prices on my books while you're there. Help me keep going so I can keep the show going. And that means with your wonderful comments as well and your guest suggestions and your story ideas too. Keep it all coming, and together we will be fruitful and abundant, just like the season of Beltane, which is a great segue to tell you what I have in store for you tonight on the show. First up tonight is Elder Priestess of Circle Sanctuary, Selena Fox, who has been so instrumental in the community for so long in so many ways, from helping deceased pagan veterans get their own religious symbol on their gravestones, her multitude of interfaith work and her political action with the Lady Liberty League, helping pagans when they've been discriminated against, and of course all the work they do at that sacred site in Wisconsin, Circle Sanctuary Nature Preserve, which it was my honor to highlight in my book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. Selena's on the show tonight talking about the importance of celebrating the seasons, whether you be a solitary or you're part of a community. I'll be asking Selena, how she thinks our ceremonies and celebrations help bring a community together. Then, crossing the threshold into the second half of the show, Michael Horowitz and Cynthia Palmer will discuss their book, Sisters of the Extreme, Women Writing on the Drug Experience, which captures the drug experiences of women from diverse times, social backgrounds, and professions, in memoir, fiction, poetry, song, and art. As listeners well know, there is a dearth of information out there on women's history of all kinds, but this book details the mythic associations of ancient history and the rituals of indigenous peoples through to the rampant opiate intoxication of the Victorian era, to the psychedelic pioneers, junkies, and anthropologists of the 20th century, all through the lens of women. Yes, we'll get into their aftervisions, revelations, and the healing powers of sacred plants as the authors tell the effects, both good and bad, of things like opium, peyote, mushrooms, LSD, and other forms of psychedelics. And these stories are from women whose names you will recognize, from Margaret Mead and Maya Angelou to Charlotte Bronte and Louisa May Alcott, Billie Holiday and Carrie Fisher, women shaman of today and yesteryear, all talking about their experience using sacred hallucinogens. But first, a brief announcement. I have two shows next week. Yes, two, on Monday and Wednesday. On Monday, Debbie Hennigan will be with me discussing spiritual connections from the other side, followed by Sally Kempton on the subject of awakening Shakti, the transformative power of the goddesses of yoga. Then on Thursday, Carl McColeman is with us to discuss Julian of Norwich, a Christian mystic of the year 1371, and the hidden dimensions of goddess within early Christianity, followed by Richard Gurevich discussing Gaian interconnectivity and the future of public myth, which will get us into a lot of topics like the Chavot Cave and goddess in the Upper Paleolithic area, era, the violent origins of patriarchal religion, Columbia, and the history of the American goddess. It's a very sweeping topic for sure, so you won't want to miss it. And just one more thing before we get to Selena, I have to share this with you. Here it goes.
The psychic state of the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth. Our ancestors understood that the animal and the divine were all connected. They were together, that there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, that's the new commercial from Jo Carson, and she is telling us about her Dancing with Gaia CD. That was some of the sound from the trailer for Dancing with Gaia, a feature documentary about earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of the goddess as Gaia. It's a sincere film that goes deep into the connections between these important topics. And the DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini book that expands on the material in the film, and you can get it all at dancingwithgaia.com. I do public service announcements here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, as well as paid commercials to help defray the cost of airtime, because we are still looking for a sponsor. Okay, then, all of that housekeeping out of the way, let me thank Selena for her patience and welcome her back to the show. Hi, Selena.
Great to be on the show, and happy Beltane for everybody celebrating in the Northern Hemisphere, and happy Samhain for those celebrating that half of the year in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, we don't think about that often, I don't think. Those of us in the Northern Hemisphere don't realize that the other part of the world is doing just the opposite.
That's right, and part of the joys of worldwide community celebrations is to have the interplay of the two halves of the year at once for every holiday.
So, Selena, you know, I have listeners on the show from all over the world, and they come from all different backgrounds, and, you know, they all aren't pagan, and some of them are new to all of this. Why don't you start with telling us, you know, what Beltane is about? You know, what did it used to be? How is it different today? Just sort of give us a rundown on, you know, what this season is about right now.
Beltane is the name of a holiday that is the midpoint between the start of spring at the equinox and the start of summer, the summer solstice. It was celebrated in ancient times as a fire festival amongst Celtic peoples. It is part of four Celtic fire festivals, each occurring at the midpoint of one of the four seasons. Beltane is a time of flowering. It's a fertility festival. It's celebrating the greening of the land, the flowering of gardens, fields, and trees. It is a time of youthful exuberance for people of all ages. The 6 months later, Festival of Samhain is one that leads into the colder time of year in the temperate zones where it's celebrated. It's the height of the fall season. The emphasis there is on honoring the dead and looking at ancestors as part of our living community, paying respects to those who've gone before, looking into the future. For many people, start their spiritual year with Samhain. But within Samhain you also have the shadows of Beltane. For with death there is rebirth, a looking ahead to the new. And within Beltane, there's the shadows of Samhain. As new life bursts forth, old forms fall away.
Yeah, it's sort of like we talk about in January and February, you know, we're leaving the darkness. That's sort of another metaphor for the old falling away, wouldn't you say?
That's right. And so much of planning seasonal celebrations for self, for family, household, spiritual community, neighborhood, really has to do with what are the inclinations of those taking part, the spiritual and philosophical orientations, and what is happening specifically with nature in the particular locale. Where I am in Wisconsin, we're celebrating Beltane with just the beginning of flowering time this year. Last year, the seasons and spring came a bit early, and we had lilacs already in bloom, which often don't bloom for us until mid-May. This year, we're just now starting to get some blooms.
So it was a slow start, is what you're saying?
This year it's very different. So when I talk with people about creating their own seasonal celebrations, look to the past, look at lore, get some inspiration there, but be sure to look outside your door,
mm-hmm.
because that will give you clues about ways to celebrate the season as it's presenting itself at a particular location at a particular year.
So just to sort of make it relevant, you know, when what I'm trying to say is, you know, for listeners who are new to this, you know, if you've been, you know, this is the perfect time of the year when you're transitioning from that space of the darkness, what you're letting go. In other words, maybe things that don't work for you, maybe bad habits you want to break, maybe you want to, you know, eat better and exercise or quit smoking or whatever it is. This is the time that you start to plant the new seeds of the new habits you want to take on or the new things you want to burst forth in your life. So that's sort of how you make the what's happening out there in the seasons relevant to your individual life, I guess, is the easiest way to say it.
That's right. It's why celebrate the seasons. First of all, it's healthy to be in tune with nature. It can be great to get a break, and these seasonal holidays not only mark the beginnings of the seasons but the midpoints. So everyone likes to take a break, and this is a way to take a break in a good way and to really heighten our awareness of nature around us. But it's also an opportunity for us to do self-reflection and correction at each of these holidays. For people who are involved in contemporary nature religion that has its roots in old Europe and the Mediterranean, also known as paganism, we celebrate at the beginnings and the midpoints of each of the seasons. So Beltane is the midpoint of spring, then we go to summer solstice, the midpoint of summer, Lunasal or Lammas. Then fall equinox, which is a time of harvest thanksgiving for us. Then we move to Samhain, which for many of us is the end of the spiritual year of seasons and a time for not only letting go of the old year passing and paying respects to the dead, but planning for the new. And then we move to winter solstice, which is the new year for people that really want to work with the calendar year, which more parallels the solar year. Here, the days start getting longer. It's traditionally been a time for peace and community and family and gifting and merrymaking. The beginning of February, the height of winter. Many people know this as Groundhog's Day, Imlek, or Candlemas, as it was known in the Middle Ages. This can be a purification time, depending on what clime you're in, but essentially it also can be a time of letting go of what's needed in preparation for the coming spring, which officially begins at spring equinox, and then that brings us back to Beltane again. So there's something really wonderful to add the rhythm to one's own life of keeping the seasonal holidays.
So, Selena, would you say that, I wonder often if, I felt as I got older, I would sort of find myself naturally, when I started to become really aware of it, that it seemed like life flowed a little bit smoother if your life was sort of in sync with the rhythms and the cycles of the earth. You know, like we're talking about, you know, in the winter you sort of take stock and you figure out, you know, what you're going to do at the beginning of the year when the sun comes, and, you know, that's when you, you know, make plans for the coming year and you plant those seeds and you work it all summer and you try to build up, you know, interest, a.k.a. fertility, and then you harvest it at harvest time and you take stock of where you're successful, and then you start all over again. You know, it's sort of this, you know, cycle of life. It helps sort of keep you motivated, keep you inspired, keeps you going, you know. Would you say that it's maybe easier if you kind of follow that rhythm of the earth, even though it is sort of subtle, rather than work against it?
Yeah, I really think part of the reason there's been a resurgence in keeping these ancient holidays has been that humans are recognizing that as we've gotten more connected with technological devices, as our work life has kept us more indoors at desk, depending on what your career path and your job life is, but essentially there's, you know, we're in vehicles, we're in offices, we're indoors, we're in human-centric spaces. That's just part of how humankind is in many parts of the world. Taking an awareness of self in relationship to nature and having these holiday times be times to really check out what's happening in the natural world puts us in sync with the much larger system that we're part of. People are part of different workplace systems, of different educational systems. They don't always take a look at the larger circle of nature of which we're part with intention. Celebrating the seasons is a really powerful way of doing that.
Well, and I think, too, it sort of keeps us motivated. It keeps us from becoming stagnant. I think that's what I wanted to say. Because we know we have this cycle of doing and doing, then you harvest it, then you reflect, and then you go, you know, beneath in winter, and you sort of, germinate under the soil, and you sort of get ready for next year's plan, and then you start all over again, hopefully being an even better version of yourself than you were the year before. I think I like that word, stagnant. It keeps us continuing to be reborn. It keeps us from becoming stagnant and stuck, and it helps us every year be a little bit better than we were, or at least changing, you know, evolving from the previous year maybe.
Yes, within our life journey, by incorporating with intention celebrations of the seasons, it does keep our energy moving. I also want to talk a little bit about what I see are three levels of celebrating the seasons. There's the deeply personal level, personal practice, whatever one's particular spiritual path might be, and a celebrating the season activity on a personal level could be as simple as taking a nature walk or putting a decoration representing that seasonal change up in one's home. Then there's what I call the human support system celebrations, the community celebrations. And with these celebrations, one is celebrating with other humans face to face often, or through the wonders of technology, including internet radio, which we're doing now. This is a way of connecting with others who also have the focus on a particular seasonal holiday and being part of other humans celebrating is a wonderful addition to one's life too. Even if one may do most of one's spiritual practice on one's own, by connecting with others through social media, through internet radio, by attending an event, one has the experience of self in relationship with others, and the joy of each of the holidays can be magnified. The third part is that of the larger circle of nature of which we're part, where we see ourselves celebrating not only personally, internally, reflectively, and socially with other humans in a community setting, but we see ourselves as part of the larger rhythm of nature from which the cycle of the seasons are integral. So an example for that, for me, would be really making a point of seeing what's happening with other life forms as I'm going about my celebration, not just paying attention to what might be in bloom or starting to bud out in my location, but spending time listening to the sounds of creatures, really getting a sense of what's happening regionally as well as in the close locale, recognizing that one is part of this much larger system, and many of the customs that have come down to us from ancient times have levels of connection with all three types. There's a personal experience, a human social experience, and then the larger nature community experience with seasonal celebrations.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about Beltane, because Beltane, I think most people sort of think of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's sort of the time of the year that's maybe more about sacred sexuality. I mean, isn't this the time when the metaphorical king and the, you know, is supposed to mate with the goddess before he, you know, it's like the dying and rising king, that he dies later on in the year. Talk about that metaphor a little bit and what it really means.
Yeah, so Beltane goes by a number of different names. Most contemporary pagans call it Beltane. Some use some older names. Some call it May Eve and May Day. And the myth cycle will vary according to the particular group that will be celebrating Beltane. For some, this is a changing of the guard. Some traditions have the divine feminine reigning from the beginning of May to the end of October. So at the beginning of May, she's youthful maiden beauty. During the summer, she's abundant mother. In the fall, she starts moving into her crone or wise old woman form. And then at the end of October, she is the wise old woman. And then the other part of the year is connected with the sacred masculine, which is often seen in connection with the sun god, waxing in and energy as the winter solstice comes on, and then being the Oak King, and then starting to shift into the Holly King just as the height of power. So some people actually will see the goddess ruling the warmer half of the year and the god the colder time of year. And while I honor that tradition, for myself, god and goddess and divine beyond gender is year-round for me. I recognize that different myth cycles are connected with different peoples and different places. And in the community celebrations that I help facilitate at Circle Sanctuary and in my travels to other parts in the U.S. and other parts of the world, I really look to see what the community has as their underpinnings, how they make sense of the stories of seasonal changes. We have summer solstice events, the Pagan Spirit Gathering, our largest community festival of the year. And there we not only celebrate the sun at its longest day of the year as sun god, Oak King at the height of his power, turning into Holly King, but we celebrate the sun and sun goddesses. And when I do the summer solstice morning ritual, I have people from a number of different traditions all celebrating the sun according to their own path, their own ethnic underpinning, their own spiritual orientation. And it's a rich tapestry of people all celebrating the longest day of the year. We also celebrate winter solstice with a very large event. We not only have our pagan winter solstice, our Yule celebration, which we have outdoors at Circle Sanctuary Nature Preserve, which is located in southwestern Wisconsin, but we have a big winter solstice pageant in Madison, Wisconsin, the nearest city of big size to us. It's about a 40-minute drive from us. And there, again, we have a multicultural celebration of winter solstice with costume characters from a variety of different spiritual and cultural traditions, all with something to share about this time. Here we have an actual enactment with Holly King and Oak King doing mock combat. And we have sun goddesses, we have Great Mother and newborn sun child, and sometimes it takes a pagan form like Isis and Horus, sometimes it takes a Christian form with Mary and Jesus. We're interreligious at that event, and it's really wonderful to see this real intermingling of different cultural myths and traditions. We don't try to mush them all together. Instead, like a really good salad, each ingredient is its own piece within the much larger salad bowl of our pageant. So to go back to your question about Beltane, we actually do look at the Jack in the Green myth, where it is the resurrected god and the vegetation god. But we also look at the green goddess as part of our celebration. We crown a May queen and a May king, which is traditional going back many, many generations, not only in pagan traditions, but people throughout the Middle Ages when Europe was Christianized kept alive May queen, May king. But in addition to May queen and May king, because our community not only has heterosexual couples, but we have same-sex couples, we have what we call the Beltane couple, the May couple. And I started this practice maybe 30-some years ago or so in order to have an opportunity for a bonded, pair-bonded couple to be able to be part of our May court as well.
Right.
So sometimes we have the May king and the May queen, and we have a male and a female couple, and sometimes we have a same-sex couple as well. And it's always the great mystery as to what the lotto, that's how we select our royal court, what the lotto will bring.
That's interesting. Well, and I think some of us don't even really understand all the time, you know, the symbols of the seasons. For instance, like the maypole, you know, you have that that dance around the maypole where some go in one direction and some go in the other, and you have that in and out weaving of the threads. I mean, that's a metaphor for sexuality, for intercourse, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, different traditions work with the maypole in different ways. We use the English maypole at Beltane for our celebrations. And our maypole, which is huge, it's more than 20 feet tall, has a crown of flowers at the top representing the divine feminine, and we have a very large pole representing the divine masculine, and we do the interweaving as a way of joining feminine and masculine together. Now,
right, so you're really saying, you're being very polite, Selena, but for people who maybe aren't getting it, the pole is the phallus and the circle of flowers is the yoni or the vagina. And so you're really reenacting sort of the fertility of the land.
Well, exactly. And we have a ritual and we have to change the actual, it's a year-round maypole. And every few years, we do change the maypole, although this particular maypole we've had quite a long time because it's very weathered, a very large pole, and it, we actually haven't had to replace it, which is good. It's really doing well. But even the whole act of us putting the maypole into the ground has had this, what you might call sensual and sexual fun type experience.
Uh-huh.
as we have that in, the men putting the pole in the ground with the women around cheering them on, and it's kind of fun. And you know, one of the things that we do with our maypole, we have a huge maypole dance and different people taking part, and some groups have the women all weave the ribbons in one direction and the men in the opposite direction. We are such a diverse community and such a colorful community because gender is not always two categories.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that particular custom in place at our festival. We let people pick which direction they want to go in.
Right.
But after we've danced the pole, one of our traditions has been those couples who want to conceive come up and touch the pole. They're the first to touch the pole. We have also other groups come up and connect with the pole for various reasons. Seniors that want some vitality as they go into their elder years will come up and they'll hold onto the pole after it's been danced to let that fertile energy come in for vitality for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Women who want to have partners go up to the pole and in hopes of kind of letting people know they're available. Men wanting partners go up to the pole and the same kind of thing. So we actually developed some of our own personal community traditions that are really a lot of fun. And another reason why we actually have a Beltane couple or a May couple in addition to the May King and the May Queen, if you are to believe some of the legends and lore about May King and May Queen from the ancient times, that some say it was a beauty contest, some say it was a popularity contest, but there was actually an expectation that the May Queen and the May King would have sex as part of the way of blessing the fields
mm-hmm.
for the community. Well, we don't require that of our May King and May Queen. No, we have a May couple. And they certainly can consummate however they plan to do it, but in the privacy of their own tent.
Right, right.
So
it's not a community
we're able
event.
To make this, you know, definitely a G-rated, family-friendly event. So, yes, there's definitely sexual and sensual components to Beltane as we celebrate it in our community, but we also have found ways to have that energy present as well as to have it multi-generational. Some of the fun things that the kids like to do, because this is a time also associated with the fae or the fairy folk. So we have kids, male and female, running around with elven and fairy and gnome and pixie-like outfits. You know, many of the young girls are running around as fairy princesses with big wings and magic wands and having a great time, and some of the adults are also dressing in costume. We bring Morris dancers out to our Beltane. Morris dancers are traditional English folk dancers, and talk about the sexuality and the sensuality connected with Beltane. Well, they literally have sticks that they strike together and they tap on the earth to awaken the fertility in the earth. It's said that the Morris dancers dancing up the May can not only bless the land but bless the people. And so we have a for real Morris dance team from the local city of Madison coming out every year to enact ancient, hundreds of years old dances, as well as some contemporary ones. And we
there's lots of layers to all of this.
Well, there are, yeah.
Well, and one other thing I was going to say, when you said, you know, how you've sort of created your own traditions, a group that I know talked about how even the ribbons, they have red ribbons and white ribbons, and the red represents the blood of the mother, the menstrual blood, that fertility, and the white is the semen of the male. So it's the two being woven together, you know, like the fertility of the egg and the seed in the womb. So, you can get so creative with all of this stuff.
Yes, and there's not only a lot of information from the past now available on the Internet and in various books and other resources, but people who are creating their own ceremonies, chants, dances, prayers, invocations are sharing their traditions as well. So one of the things that I encourage people to do that want to celebrate the seasons for themselves, for their household, other community they're part of, and that larger picture of which we're all part, is to pay attention to what's going on in one's own environment, do some research in terms of one's own personal ethnic heritage, and what's going on in the locale where one is at in terms of customs. We're near Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, which was settled by people from Scandinavia. So we have a number of holidays that happen that have their roots in the old pagan holidays of Scandinavia. And, you know, part of our celebration is not only being at Circle Sanctuary and welcoming in the spring, but also going to some art fair and other community events to welcome in the spring in the local town. Same way with fall festivals. We have a fall festival at our center, but we also take part in the harvest celebrations of this agricultural town that we're near.
Right.
So yeah, you're right.
Well, so, Selena, let me ask you about this diversity. You know, diversity is a wonderful thing, and I believe that sincerely. But I wonder, though, sometimes, and let me give you the context for this question. I'm part of a group that does wisdom circles every month, and we have this bowl that the regulars of the group get to put a hypothetical question in the bowl, and we pull a question or two or three every gathering, and we discuss the question. And the last time we got together, the question came up about the paganism, for instance, that there are so many diverse groups You know, there's the Iceans, there's the Celtic people, there's the Norse, there's the Native American. We're so diverse. And we have no similar creation story necessarily, no similar heaven story, you know, life after death. We certainly don't have a fear-based spirituality, like we're going to burn in hell if we don't do such and such and such.
Mm-hmm.
So with that diversity, with that diversity of the traditions, with that we don't have a shared liturgy like a Bible. Do you think, in a way, our diversity and maybe works against us a little bit, because it's like we don't end up being this cohesive group, like, say, Christians, and that maybe prevents us from becoming an influential movement because we're just sort of all over the place?
You're right about pagan diversity. There really is a range of different traditions, and where is the paganism rooted in the past? How current is it? Is it evolving? Is it something that is really trying to hold to a set process for doing celebrations and rituals and that type of thing? There are several ways to address the diversity if you're doing a large community gathering. At Circle Sanctuary Nature Preserve, we have people from many different traditions of paganism come. So some of the approaches that we take are to have rituals with some common ground for everyone, that everyone can join in, that isn't tied to a particular flavor of paganism. It's
mm-hmm.
isn't so much it's generic, but it's more universalist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we also have some rituals that are specifically from a tradition,
mm-hmm.
and we have that available. And those who want to take part can certainly take part. And then at another festival, we may have a different tradition with one of our main rituals.
Right.
And that is a way that we are able to experience that diversity. I do think there are some common denominators across all the pagan traditions. One of them is celebrating the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
The names may be called differently. What date one may be celebrating may be different, and there can be a whole difference in what the name of the sacred form is that's being honored, or a god and a goddess, or just a goddess, or just a god. So there are those variations. However, the idea of being in touch with the land in a sacred way, the idea of being in tune with the rhythms of nature in a sacred way, that's very universal across the different pagan traditions.
Yeah, that's actually what we came up with at the Wisdom Circle, because, you know, we talked about how, I mean, look at Constantine, for instance. You know, he decided all of these diverse pagan groups was too much to deal with. So, you know, it turned out, I mean, you know, and I'm saying this sort of, and so he decided that, you know, it was better to have one sort of faith across the board, I guess, for unity and cohesiveness, and we end up with Christianity. And, I mean, that's not, of course, the only explanation, but, you know, that's part of it. And because, you know, as a pagan, it's not like you can, if somebody comes up to you and says, well, what do you guys believe? It's not like you can point to a Bible, or you can't point to a Ten Commandments, you know.
Well, we are not people of the book or
right.
a main book, but
mm-hmm.
I talk about nature being our book when people in Abrahamic faiths are talking about sacred texts. And certainly there are texts that have survived from the ancient pagan times that some traditions will work with as part of their own practices. But I actually see nature as teacher and nature as a form that we can, in all of its diversity, that we can celebrate. I also think the idea of honoring our ancestors, wherever they may have come from, you will find, even if ancestor honoring may not be an official part of a particular pagan ritual, it's implied, it's built in, especially in community settings where one is being part of a continuity, whether it's a revival or an actual survival in some respects of an old pagan tradition. So connecting with ancestors, connecting with cycles of seasons, celebrating the cycles of life, which are also part of nature, you know, baby blessings, coming of age into adulthood, the celebration of marriage, moving into seniorhood, and death, final passage. So there's the cycle of the seasons, there's the cycle of life, and for some groups, they also celebrate the cycles of the moon. And these can be really powerful common denominators across different pagan traditions. And I think that when we talk about community celebration, that even if we happen to be doing work with a very small group or just on our own, at these seasonal holidays, we can energetically connect with all of those others, with all their diversity, celebrating and keeping the holiday. And I endeavor to have that as part of my personal practice, as part of community rituals that I facilitate, to really bring forth that awareness that even if we may be just with a few people or on our own, that actually we're part of that larger system of nature where not only humans from many places are all celebrating, but we're also part of that larger rhythm that is the seasons.
Right, right. Well, you know, we have a little bit of time left before my next guest. I you know, because you've been around a long time, Selena. You know the history of paganism in the United States. You know, you deal with so much on so many different levels. What do you think are the biggest challenges pagans have today? You know, that, I mean, what progress have we made? You know, but what do we, you know, what are still our biggest challenges ahead?
We need to have it possible for a pagan, whether the pagan is a Wiccan, a Druid, a goddess spirituality practitioner, a heathen, a pantheist, an Icean, you know, whatever their pagan path. We need to be in a society where a pagan can run for public office and not have paganism be something that has to be explained or countered. That's my eyes on the prize, right, in terms of pagans being able to be more openly pagan within society and be able to do public service without that being an issue. We are not there yet. Could there be a president in the White House, in the USA, who's pagan? I've talked about that from time to time, and many pagans haven't really thought about that concept, but I hope that the US of A will evolve itself with celebrating diversity, that a pagan who is well qualified, who is bright, who's dedicated, and has all those good leadership skills and well funded, which you have to have in this country at this time, will be able to get into the White House and be the president, male or female, and be a pagan without that being a big problem. But we're still trying to get our basic civil rights in this country implemented in different parts of the country. So that is still a challenge. We are not yet in a country with liberty and justice for all fully implemented.
And it's amazing that the people who think that there is freedom of religion. I mean, I know Patrick McCollum talks about the Tier 1 and Tier 2 religions. That's for another conversation. People can Google it. But it really is difficult for pagans out there. I mean, they can lose their children. They can be denied housing. You were just, you know, fighting to get pentagrams on veterans' graves because here they can die for their country, but they can't you know, have their religion acknowledged on their grave until that effort you and all those folks that you worked with went through for that. It's really a challenge, isn't it?
It can be. I've seen a lot of advances though, which I really, in pointing out where there's still a long way to go, we still have to keep in mind how much has really been accomplished, because now paganism often is at the table along with other religions at interreligious gatherings. That's fabulous. There are people who are in the performing arts that have let their paganism be known without that being problematic. It actually has helped them, I think, in some cases. There are people who are able to live openly as pagans in their communities without that being a hassle. And I should say that at Beltane time in the USA and some other parts of the world, May 2nd has started becoming national or global Pagan Coming Out Day.
Really?
And yeah, so there are many people who are encouraging others who are pagan to become more visible.
That's
if
tomorrow.
Indeed that works for them in their communities and they're at a readiness point. I don't think it's right for all pagans to be out in every circumstance and every place yet. There's still misunderstanding and discrimination. But I do encourage people to be able to be more visible about their paganism, whether they choose to really totally out themselves about that or not. And I really do think the more pagans become visible in the larger society and the more the pagan roots within the U.S. and other places become more known, then there'll be a more equitable climate and more understanding about paganism. Some of the things that I've worked on lately have included working with pagans who have been harassed because they're pagan. There was a family in Newport Richey, Florida, that have had over the past several months people who drive by screamings and hollerings, and then it turned into pellet guns being used and shooting out windows, and then it escalated to two bottle bombs with toxic chemicals being thrown at the people in their yard, and one person ended up having to go to the emergency room for a while. You know, we have to stop hate wherever it is, whether it's anti-pagan hate or hate against other minority groups or even majority groups. I think we really have to take a look at society and find ways to stop bullying, stop harassment, stop discrimination, and to stop the hate mongers. And one of the ways of doing that is exactly what we're doing right now, talking about issues, talking about solutions, and making it visible that these things exist, and hopefully come up with ways that we can collaborate together to work for a better world, not just in our country and our neighborhoods, but the world as a whole. You know, we have a beautiful, precious planet. It's going through a lot of transformation. There are a lot of needs. But I do think each of us can select something that we can do to work for the greater good. No matter what the holiday is that I am celebrating, I always spend time in personal ritual with that vision of prayers for a better world and reflection on what I personally can do to help make that happen, and in community ceremonies I facilitate, including the maypole dancing that we'll be doing this weekend. We not only have blessings for individuals in our community going up and touching the pole that's been energized, but our big working is to have that fertility energy, that vitality, that joy, not only go into the land for beauty and abundance and well-being of our land and the gardening and the wildcrafting and all of that that we do, but for the planet as a whole. So I would invite listeners, as you think about what you may be celebrating in the next few days, whether it's Beltane in the Northern Hemisphere or Samhain in the Southern Hemisphere, to take some time to appreciate your connection with nature, pay attention to what nature is doing in your area, but also put some well wishes out for that greater circle of life of which we're all part.
Well said, Selena. Thank you very much. Well, I appreciate you being back on the show and sharing your words of wisdom as always. And I wish you a good Beltane this season. And thank you very much, Selena.
Well, thank you for having me on. And those who really want to get more information about celebrating the seasons, I do have my online guide at www.circlesanctuary.org, or you can follow me on Facebook, Selena Fox Updates, or Selena_Fox on Twitter. And what I do to celebrate the season is put out resources, photographs, prayers, rituals, links to a variety of different resources, because I really think no matter what one's religion or culture might be, getting in touch with nature and having a good time celebrating the seasons, good for yourself, good for the planet, good for the larger system of which we're all part. Thanks again for having me on your show.
Oh, you're welcome, Selena. Thank you for your wise words. I appreciate it all the time. Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, that's been Selena Fox from Circle Sanctuary, and I see my next guests are on the switchboard, and I'm going to be getting to Michael and Cynthia in just a moment. But first, a new artist that I'm introducing to the show, her name is Celia, and I'm going to let you hear a short song of hers called Bringing in the Light. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with our next guests in just a moment. So enjoy Celia, Bringing in the Light.
Yeah, I'm bringing in the light, been in the darkness for too long. Yeah, I'm bringing in the light, bringing in the light by the way of the song. It's the love I give, turns to happiness. Bringing in the joy, bringing in the light, bringing in the bliss. I'm dropping the worry, I'm dropping the shame, I'm dropping the guilt, I'm dropping the blame. I'm dropping the walls, I'm dropping the windows, dropping the doors. I'm dropping who's wrong, I'm dropping who's right, I'm dropping my put 'em up and fight. I'm dropping the roof, I'm dropping the porch, I'm dropping the floors. And I'm bringing in the light, been in the darkness for too long. Yeah, I'm bringing in the light, bringing in the light by the way of the song. It's the love I give, turns to happiness. Bringing in the joy, bringing in the light, bringing in the bliss. I'm dropping the plan, I'm dropping the plot, I'm dropping the twist me up in knots. I'm dropping the past, prevailing over what's in store. I'm dropping the scarcity of enough, I'm dropping that constellated stuff. I'm dropping the points, I'm dropping the game, I'm dropping the score. And I'm bringing in the light, been in the darkness for too long. Yeah, I'm bringing in the light, bringing in the light by the way of the song. It's the love I give, turns to happiness. Bringing in the joy, bringing in the light, bringing in the bliss. Everything's gonna be fine as I let my heart's light shine. Yeah, I'm bringing in the light, bringing in the darkness. Yeah, I'm bringing in the light, bringing in the light by the way of the song. It's the love I give, through happiness. Bringing in the joy, bringing in the light, bringing in the bliss. Bringing in the joy, bringing in the light, bringing in the bliss. Bringing in the joy, bringing in the light, bringing in the bliss.
Well, I hope you're getting comfortable and with your cup of tea or your glass of wine, because pretty soon here we're going to be chatting with Cynthia Palmer and Michael Horowitz about their book, Sisters of the Extreme, Women Writing on the Drug Experience. And we'll be talking about women like Charlotte Bronte and Louisa May Alcott and Maya Angelou and Carrie Fisher. Just a couple quick announcements before we start that chat. I want to find out if you know about the Goddess Spirit Rising Conference. It's an international retreat on the Pacific in Malibu, California, September 6th, 7th, and 8th. The organizers say join them for three amazing days of workshops, ceremony, wisdom with world-renowned presenters, plus artists, musicians, vendors, readers, and healers. They want to make this an amazing conference. It's the first of its kind in Southern California. If you're nearby, if you're within driving distance, they invite you to come and look into it a little bit more at their website, goddessspiritrising.com. And I hope you will subscribe to my new blog called Herstory with Karen Tate on Blogger. Also, please go to my Facebook page and like my new Voices of the Sacred Feminine radio page. And I want to say thanks again for Cindy Williams for helping me get both of those up and going. And wondering if you know one of our show mottos. Well, it goes like this. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And that is by Gandhi. I think that's a perfect motto for those of us who believe we really need a shift away from dominator patriarchal ideas that benefit mostly the 1% at the top and leave the rest of the 99% suffering at the bottom of the heap. Until we become a society of more equality, until we defeat the devastating income disparity so many are suffering from, until we can beat down this austerity so many have thrust upon them, until we start thinking about the general welfare and the common good, all goddess ideals, by the way, we will continue here beating the drum for the sacred feminine, deity, archetype, and ideal for a world of caring and sharing where greed is once again considered a deadly sin. I think depending on where you are, you're experiencing different parts of Gandhi's quote that I just read. Some of us are experiencing that we're being ignored. Others are feeling laughed at. Still others feel them fighting us, but we are also tasting wins as well. But there is much yet to do to eradicate the sexism, racism, homophobia, fascism, and general exploitation across the globe. Well, that said, we are crossing the threshold into the second part of the show, and I hope you'll stay tuned in after my next interview because I have some things to share with you. I am trying to unmute. Here we go. There we go. Michael and Cynthia are now unmuted. And I want to thank them for calling in tonight to discuss their book. Let me tell you a little bit about them before we get going here and start our chat. Cynthia and Michael are psychoactive drug historians who have edited two books together. The first is Moksha, Aldous Huxley's Writings on the Psychedelic Experience. I hope I got those names right. If not, I hope they'll correct me. And the second is the book we're discussing tonight, Sisters of the Extreme, Women's Writings on the Drug Experience. We've been they have been partners since the 60s and have four grown children. And I want to say welcome, Cynthia. Welcome, Michael, to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, Karen. Nice to be here.
Well, we have a mutual friend, David Hillman. I believe you met him recently at a conference.
We did, indeed, a few months ago here in Vancouver.
Well, you know, it was David that really started getting me interested in the use of hallucinogens in the ancient world. His book, The Chemical Muse, which he had a whole lot of trouble with in his thesis and, you know, had to pull a lot of the research he did out of his thesis in order to get it accepted, really started to pique my curiosity and a lot of my listeners. And so we started to delve into different things like this and not just, sort of accept what's, dished out to us by the status quo, so to speak. And one of my listeners, made me aware of your book. So I'm so glad to hear to have you here with us tonight, especially since this is through the lens of women, because there's such a dearth of information out there on women's history in a lot of cases. You know, the words of women, you know, unfortunately in our culture, still seem to be secondary. And then when you're talking about something like hallucinogens, well, it's even more taboo, wouldn't you say?
Exactly. The reason we did our book was because there were men's experiences with drugs, and many great writers like De Quincey and Coleridge and Baudelaire, and Aldous Huxley and Tim Leary have all written brilliantly. And by the way, David Hillman is quite a brilliant writer. We were very impressed with his talk. But there were no women's accounts, and that's why we put together a book of those accounts. And we were surprised to find out how many there were and how they were very much on the level of brilliance in the writing and the description of states of consciousness that men had written. And
Well, let me ask you first, before we get into the book, I'm curious about the experience you've had as you introduced your book to the world. Was yours similar to David's in the sense that there was resistance to what you had to say? Because, you know, it seems like there's still an incredible prejudice out there, even though, you know, we know some of these hallucinogens can really improve our cognitive abilities and our creativity and all of that. You know, it just sort of comes across as if they're all bad all the time. And so did you get any kind of a backlash, I'm wondering?
Not really, because in the last 30, 40 years, it's been much. Publishers have been much more open towards our books. Things changed a lot in the 60s, and since then, many books have been published on the drug experience. A lot of science has been done increasingly in recent years. So.
Okay.
We didn't have any. Resistance, did we?
I think people were really interested and curious and fascinated by altered states, and it became more acceptable in the 60s to actually discuss these things, let alone experience them. You know, so I think we. I mean, basically, there was quite a bit of interest. You know.
Okay. Well, was there one thing in particular that motivated you to do the book?
Well, our own experiences, actually. We were of the 60s, and we experimented ourselves, and we were astonished to find out that there are altered states of consciousness available and that they were very rewarding if done properly.
Well, you know, I remember hearing recently on the radio they were talking about the Beatles' experience in India and how, you know, it was one of, the, you know, became one of their most creative periods, you know, when they were delving into meditation and hallucinogens. And I think that was when they wrote Sgt. Pepper, some say, you
That's
know,
right.
maybe some of their greatest work. You know, and it sort of maybe makes people who have been afraid to do anything like this, I don't know, maybe take a chance under the right circumstances and see how it may affect their creativity, their, you know, or improve their cognitive ability. Or
that's right, that we've seen that. And we've delved into the history. We're historians, basically. We love to study the past, and especially to uncover the information that has been suppressed for a long time. And drugs are one of the forbidden history of mankind, womankind. It's really the history of psychoactive drugs, of mind-altering drugs. And that is one of the most, you know, suppressed areas of knowledge that there is. And we're trying to make a difference there, but our angle was women's place in that whole thing.
Well, now you talk about in the beginning of the book, you get into you know, how women and mind altering drugs and herbs go back a long way. You know, it goes back to you know, to goddesses and priestesses.
Yes.
You know, why don't I mean, that's really, you know, what a lot of my listeners really like to hear about, as well.
Sure.
As we want to talk about some of the more contemporary women. But let's start at the beginning. Tell us about the goddesses and mythic figures, and maybe even women from antiquity that were associated with some of these herbs or hallucinogens.
Sure. Actually, we can go back probably further than this, but the 14th century BC, there's a famous statue of a poppy goddess from Crete, 14th century BC. She has poppies coming out of her head, and those other goddesses and other statues with poppies have been found in other cultures. There's in ancient Egypt, for example, there were many deities that were probably part real and part mythological, like Hathor and Isis and Nefertiti, who are associated with the medical knowledge of healing and drug plants. Cleopatra was.
What you really do see when you look at the history is that to have knowledge of herbs and how to grow them and to know what their uses were, because, you know, in ancient history there weren't painkillers like we have today. I mean, there was surgery without painkillers. There were a lot of needs for different types of medicine. So you do see that the privileged class, the people like Cleopatra and you know, gods and goddesses of the time, were educated highly in this area. And, the more knowledge they had about healing and about the uses of intoxicating plants, the more deified they were, the more important they were to their culture.
Well, I know David Hillman talks about how, in a way, even feminists have sort of missed an opportunity to show how powerful women in ancient times were, because,
that's,
you know, he
true.
Says women
yeah.
were the first pharmacologists, you know, so they held life and death in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and when we talk about the poppy goddesses, well, you're obviously talking about opium. But then you also have Eve with, you say she's associated with the apple and the mushroom.
Yeah, Eve. To us, she's a central figure in Western culture, and she's the story of Eve is probably the most significant one. Although David Hillman found so much drug use in ancient Greece, the cradle of Western civilization, that it's just astonishing. It was like beyond the 60s, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to Eve. The what happened in the Garden of Eden is kind of central to how drugs are viewed today and how women have been viewed for centuries. The garden had the tree of knowledge, and there was a forbidden fruit hanging there. There was the serpent. The serpent is like the shaman or the drug dealer, and Eve was the one who was seduced by the serpent, perhaps, or was the curious one of the two between Adam and Eve. And she tried, you know, she ate the forbidden fruit, and then she talked Adam into eating the forbidden fruit. Now, that forbidden fruit is always, you know, typically personified as an apple, but it was probably an Amanita muscaria mushroom. That isn't just supposition. In the last 30 or 40 years, stained glass windows in many European churches, quite a few, scores, show the apple more represented as a mushroom. That's the red mushroom with the white spots, the toadstool mushroom, the fly agaric mushroom, or the Amanita muscaria is the official name. It's a mind-altering mushroom. And it was probably really, I mean, of course, this is, now we're talking about a myth here, but, you know, myths are based on you know, events, and there's a very strong suspicion that the first forbidden drug, which was also the first controlled substance, is another way of looking at it, and it angered God when, you know, the fruit was eaten. And you want to say something?
Well, I was about to say that gives a whole new twist to the Eve story, because, you know, we think of the apple as just knowledge. Well, knowledge can be so many things, but now we're even
exactly.
thinking about, well, knowledge could also be altered states. Altered states, we know, for instance, I mean, I had Carl Ruck on the show. We talked about the Eleusinian mysteries,
exactly.
and people used, you know, probably, you know, some sort of mushrooms or a form of LSD or something like that in the Eleusinian mysteries see God. So I don't know, it reminds me of like the Tower of Babel idea. The whole idea was God didn't want man to communicate with one another. He didn't want them getting too big, you know, being able to communicate with each other. Well, you know, that sort of, the words are failing me now, but it's almost as if, you know, the Abrahamic God,
like,
you know, didn't want competition. He's a, you know, he's a jealous God. You know, he doesn't want man rising too high.
You know, speaking of Aaron, that's before that there was the matriarchal God and the goddess, I should say, or society, in which actually small doses of snake venom, we uncovered this, were used as hallucinogens. Very tiny doses, obviously, wouldn't be fatal. But that's the kind of knowledge that was passed on, you know, through the ages to Cleopatra. But associated with, you know, with Eve, beginning with Eve, is the association of women with the principle of yin, and the linkage to nature and the earth, to the inner self, to unfathomable pleasure and endlessly receptive experience, mystical intuitive wisdom, and eroticism. These are all aspects of some of the psychoactive plants. Not all, of course.
And those are all things that the patriarchy would not want in the hands of the average person.
Exactly.
You know, it's all about power and control, isn't it? It always goes back to power and control. Keep the people down. Keep the people controlled.
That's right.
Keep the people unempowered. Don't let them have this knowledge because, gee, we might not be able to control what they think then. You know, they want a bunch of sheeple, basically.
That's exactly what's happened with the drug culture today. I mean, it's imprisonment today for... you know, controlled substances, and that follows this long tradition of patriarchal tradition, which is a fear of the yin principle, a fear of nature, actually. That goes
right.
with,
yeah.
you know, the corporations and the 1% and, you know, the natural resources that are, you know, being exploited.
Yeah, it's really really interesting, isn't it, when you start to be able to connect all of these dots and you see how all of this is really interrelated. You know, the fear of nature, the fear of woman, the fear of the ideals that are associated with nature and woman, you know, pleasure, knowledge, transparency, you know, equality, you know, all of these things. You know, these are the enemies of the patriarchy, which, you know, I think, you know, maybe more of society is starting to get. But you also talked about Helen of Troy. She was associated with cannabis and opium.
That's correct. She gave Odysseus's son, Telemachus, a mirth-inspiring drug. In those days, opium and cannabis were usually taken together. There was usually a mixture of the two. So there was that opiated relaxation and forgetfulness and dreaminess and sleepiness. He was tortured by the fact that his father had been away for 20 years. and no word from him. He was out on his adventures. And there was also the mirth-inspiring aspect of that. That's how scholars came to realize that there was cannabis, you know, which is something that makes people, you know, in the right conditions, you know, very relaxed.
So that's marijuana. We're talking marijuana when you say cannabis.
Yes, yeah, marijuana.
That's right.
I mean, that
that's
it
right.
kind of makes you giddy and
yeah.
relaxed and kind of silly. And so it was definitely a popular combination.
The most, probably.
And then
yeah.
What was there more to that? Because I was going to go on
well,
to...
It's a famous scene in The Odyssey in which, you know, and it's been represented in pictures. There was, our book has hundreds of illustrations, many of them, you know, of the ancient goddesses. That's how we open the book. Then we moved on, though, from there to another interesting drug myth, which again involves a combination of opium and marijuana, which is, and this is from the East. It actually originated in India, but it was picked up, and it's famous for being Persian, and that would be Scheherazade, who the heroine of the 1001 Nights.
Mm-hmm.
And her story is so well known here, though it's a 12th century story that it was probably earlier than that. It reached Persia in the 12th century. It didn't reach the Western world, Europe, until the 18th century, and then it was totally embraced. You know, Middle Eastern literature was, you know, very much, you know, excited the imaginations of a lot of American writers and English writers. Her story is really interesting because, in terms of the story of, she was like a goddess, but she was also an activist, and she and her sister's often forgotten, Dunyazad, I believe, and I'm sure it's pronounced, let me try that again, Dunyazad. The story, of course, is that the Sultan, found out that his wife was cheating on him, or at least he believed she was, and he had her executed. And after that, he would marry a virgin and have her executed one night with her, a one-night stand with a virgin, and then executed the next morning. And he was, like, slowly, like, decimating all the young women in the land. Scheherazade, who was very learned, had a plan, and her plan was, and she needed his sister for this, was to keep the Sultan, you know, at ease by telling him stories, a labyrinth of stories, 1001 of them, actually. And in order to keep him listening, her sister filled his hookah with a mixture of opium and hashish. And he smoked constantly, listened to the stories, and never got around to executing Scheherazade.
It was
3 years passed.
The ultimate distraction.
Ultimate distraction. She bore him 3 children in the next 3 years, and after that he was ready. He threw in the towel. He let her live as his queen, and no other women were executed.
So here she was, one of the first, you know, women's rights activists. Well, when you talk too about witches as herbalists, use psychedelic ointment to induce fantasies of flying. Could that possibly be connected to the idea of witches on their brooms?
Completely.
Yes,
wow.
Exactly. And that was revelatory to me too. It was so interesting, you know, that they had these ointments that were really gave you a sensation of flying, and they were depicted that way.
Huh.
These were a little different than opium and hashish. These were the solanaceous family. They're henbane and belladonna. They're the kind of plants that were very well known and used medically in medieval times and the Renaissance. But they're true hallucinogens. You know, LSD isn't really hallucinogen. You know, you see through, you know, the doors of perception, but the plants that the witches or herbalists, female herbalists used, the Wiccans, were actually these plants that were deeply, truly hallucinogenic. And so you can have fantasies of flying. And they actually, it was actually a paste. The broomstick idea was actually, this was, you know, kind of uncovered research about 100 years ago. It was inserted in the vagina to bring about this state of, all the state of consciousness in which there were fantasies of flying. It was a sexual thing.
Right,
and of course,
right.
The resistance against that was gigantic. I don't know how many millions were killed for this kind of, you know, seeking out experiences like this. They were really just trying to, you know, live with nature.
Also, probably trying to escape the drudgery of that
yeah.
life in the dark ages. I mean, God,
and
wouldn't you want to escape that too?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, Cynthia, tell us a little bit. We're talking about, you know, real life people mm-hmm. as opposed to goddesses. Sappho with her ambrosia and the Pythias with the laurel leaves.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, all of these were like the laurel leaves were burned with other herbs as well. And essentially, Pythia was a seer. She predicted the future. And her ritual was to burn these leaves together in conches.
And inhale the fumes.
Yes, and inhale the fumes and basically get herself into an intoxicated state and then solve the problems of the community. I mean, she was consulted by all different members of the community for social reasons, for political reasons, for problems within the community, and she would put herself into an altered state, and that was, you know, that's really like one of the big aspects of our book is kind of distinguishing between the shamanic use of drugs and the what we called originally shaman woman, mainline lady, the addictive use of drugs, because, you know, you have both sides of the coin, essentially.
Right.
And for a long time, like in the 1900s, the 1800s, there was no regulation of drugs. They didn't have a pure food and drug department, you know, that regulated drugs. So you had many opiated syrups and syrups that were extremely strong. And people really didn't understand, you know, the dynamic of addiction.
But the writers of the 19th century, some of the greatest writers of the 19th century were used opium. Everybody used opium in the 19th century. And Louisa May Alcott was familiar with hashish, which was sold openly. All drugs were legal in the 19th century. And there wasn't really a major drug problem until, you know, the drugs were synthesized into much stronger drugs like heroin,
but,
for example.
But people were getting addicted, and they essentially in the 1800s, the silent majority of people who were addicted were women. And this was because women went to doctors for menstrual cramps and for what they called female troubles. And the doctors said the easiest thing for them to do was to prescribe laudanum and opiates.
So it was sort of like they were keeping them sedated? Was that?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't consider that to be really what they were doing. They felt like they were relieving pain, but what was really happening, and probably the very first alarming situations of addiction were when babies were treated for their colic with opiated syrup, and then it was withdrawn from them, and they would begin to jaundice, and they began to understand then that there was something very serious going on here. And it was really, one of the first accounts, really, of dose reduction and becoming less addicted and finally becoming not addicted is of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And her story is famous, you know, because of Robert Browning and Elizabeth Barrett being wonderful
great love story
and lovers and so forth. But she was also an invalid. and she had been addicted to morphine, grass, and opium for years and years. And it was really, you know, the strength of her love and her desire to be with Robert Browning and his, you know, absolute activism in terms of understanding that maybe she could come off of it if he just gave her a little bit less every day.
And she right. she wrote great poetry under the effects of opium. Charlotte Bronte wrote a great the novel The Let, in which the heroine uses opium. And Cindy, you were going to read something from Louisa May Alcott, perhaps, which where actually it's the literature and memoir that interests us even more than the, you know, the medical part of it.
Go right ahead.
Well, I was going to read just a little bit to give you the tone of it from a short story that
okay.
she wrote. I mean, one of the things about her that's so interesting
1867.
Is that she wrote under a pseudonym for kind of the Sunday Gazette, and she wrote these semi-lurid stories. And this one is about a kind of group of picnickers, kind of upper-middle-class picnickers. And this is how it starts. If someone does not propose a new and interesting amusement, I shall die of ennui, said pretty Bella Daventry in a tone of despair. I have read all of my books and used up all my Berlin wools, and it's too warm to go out there for more. No one can go sailing yet, as the tide is out, and we are all nearly tired to death of cards, croquet, and hockey. So what shall we do to while away this endless afternoon? Dr. Meredith, I command you to invent and propose a new game in 5 minutes. So here is to obey, replied the young man, who lay in the grass at her feet as he submissively slapped his forehead and fell a-thinking with all his might. And then it goes on to describe this group of picnickers, and two of them are
teenagers, by the way, probably
a handsome man and a beautiful girl, and who have kind of are looking at each other but are too shy to say anything to each other. And after a while, he pulls out this little box of pompous, and she says, "Okay, time is up, doctor," and he says, "Ready to report," and shows her this little tortoise shell case. "How mysterious. What is it? Let me see." And Bell removes the cover, looking like an inquisitive child. "Only bonbons. How stupid. That won't do, sir. We don't want to be fed with candy. We demand to be amused. Eat 6 of these 5 bonbons, and you will be amused in a new, delicious, and wonderful manner," the young doctor, laying half a dozen on a green leaf and offering them to her. And then essentially what happens is that these young people take these pompous and they
hashy sliced.
Yeah, so it's like brownies.
Yes,
exactly. That was very popular. It was sold 6 for a quarter in the 1860s during the period of the Civil War.
Sure. I mean, you could just go down to the pharmacy and order them.
In this case,
you know, the young couple who have been looking at each other end up taking a boat ride out on the lake, and they get extremely stoned, and they become much more kind of candid with each other than the time permits. And really, you know, a lot of the reason that there was the use of laudanum and things like the hashish pompous in the literature of the 19th century was to give an excuse for people to loosen up.
To sort of let their inhibitions go a little bit, because it was such a rigid society.
Inhibitive time.
Exactly. So it was, women could do, you know, like in the book that by Charlotte Bronte that Mike was describing, Dillette, like she takes some opiated medicine before she's in order to go to sleep. But what happens is she takes too much and she gets overstimulated, and she's like a 19th century Victorian lady, and she ends up going out late at night by herself and taking a walk to town. And this is really a taboo. I mean, a young woman didn't go out late at night unescorted. And so, you know, it's like to open the door for female characters to have more adventures and to do, you know, more daring things.
Interesting.
That's something, you know, what Alcott and Bronte and many of the writers of the time were using it for.
Well, so let me understand. So they were using it it two ways in a way, not just to, you know, open their creativity, but it helped them lower their inhibitions, so they maybe actually went and did things that they wouldn't have done
exactly.
Under the influence.
Yes. Yes.
So both. I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And probably the most druggy book of the entire 19th century. Well, it was actually written by a man, but the heroine is Alice, and it's Alice Through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland, and which is the drug allegory, actually. The looking glass, she goes into a hallucinated state, and during her adventures underground, which is interesting, that it is underground, it's always the underground where, you know, these drug cultures seem to emerge from, she twice eats psychoactive cake, which is the hashish confection, popular in England and U.S., that Cindy was just describing in Louisa May Alcott's story. She twice drinks from a bottle, which is laudanum, opium in alcohol, which was, you know, the medical, opiated medicine, very common, particularly prescribed to women. And she has five experiences with a piece of a hallucinogenic mushroom. And on that mushroom, of course, is the hookah-smoking caterpillar. And he's like the serpent in the garden, except in the Lewis Carroll story, he's actually kind of more amusing than sinister and threatening, though he has that side also. And
well, that's
interesting.
So here's a drug story that becomes a child's story.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that very well known? I mean,
there was a book published. Yeah, it's not well known. We discussed it in our book, and it's been Alice in Acidland was a book published in 1970, the first time anybody ever discussed it. Because it's always been known that there was the caterpillar with a hookah sitting on top of a mushroom, and that when the most famous. One of the most famous things, when she eats a piece of it, she grows very tall and then very small.
Well, that song, who sang it? White
Grace
Rabbit.
Grace Slick. And that's a good segue there, Karen, because Grace Slick in the 1960s wrote the song.
White Rabbit.
It was the anthem, the hippie anthem. And there are, you know, she Go Ask Alice is one of the lines in the song. Feed Your Head is another. Of course, they got into a lot of trouble for that, but the song was wildly popular, and it's still, you know, still played a lot. And she definitely one pill makes you larger, one pill makes you small. She was very much continuing the tradition of Alice, and so Alice stands as kind of like a figure, a great figure in the history of consciousness expansion and of female liberation.
Right, right, right.
Through altered states of consciousness.
Well, that's sort of the key to it all, isn't it? It's women's liberation through altered states of consciousness, because maybe in some cases they were constrained by society and culture.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, tell me this, as you were reading that portion, Cynthia, it occurred to me that you were reading about well-to-do people, people who were easily bored, women that didn't have to toil and, you know, raise children in squalor.
That's absolutely true.
So was this sort of a distraction for the rich, or did the poor also partake of this? I mean, were poor women being given laudanum?
I actually think that was the point I was going to make, actually, is laudanum basically crossed all of the kind of social barriers, because it was so commonly prescribed that the poorest person could afford laudanum. It was extremely cheap and extremely effective. So across all of the social barriers, you could purchase laudanum and become addicted to it. But things like, in this particular case, like the bonbons and smoking combinations of hash and marijuana, those were less common. And I would say that that probably was more, aside from smoking opium, which crossed all the social barriers too, smoking those other things was probably more for a privileged class.
So when did things shift? I mean, when did it go from being socially acceptable to being, you know, taboo? I mean, I remember the Reagan administration, you know, Nancy Reagan's whole thing was just say no.
That's right, yeah.
You know, when did things change?
It actually shifted. It began to shift around 1900 when the Food and Drug Administration came in. Now, there are a couple of things there. There were problems with cocaine, for the synthetic drugs like heroin and cocaine. Those drugs had just been synthesized, and they were causing significant problems in society. And that's when addiction became criminalized. I mean, and that was not the way to go to cure addiction. But the other aspect of that was the minorities, particularly, you know, Mexicans bringing in marijuana was first. Marijuana first came in from Mexico in the 1920s. Prior to that, there was the Chinese with opium. That was before 1900. Drug laws were created, partly to marginalize and criminalize new populations that were not, you know, the white Caucasians, the ruling class.
And also, there wasn't a lot of knowledge about addiction. I mean, like, the idea of, like, it being a medical problem was really foreign. It was more, this is a criminal problem, and these drugs should be outlawed.
Yeah.
So they didn't really understand addiction that well.
Because it was useful politically. And, of course, there were many who did understand it, but they were in the minority.
Well, was this also so the pharmaceutical companies could control it and make money, or is that a more contemporary thing?
Well, I think laudanum was a big moneymaker, like at the turn of the century, beginning of 1900. But really what was happening was that addiction was beginning to manifest itself. And, like, the Pure Food and Drug Act was enacted in 1906. And that was the very first time you had to list the ingredients of your bottles or your medications on a label.
It wasn't all a bad idea, you know, the Pure
right.
and Drug Act.
No, but it was a good idea. And for instance, there were coca leaves in Coca-Cola. That's what it was called, was Coca-Cola.
Right. Right.
And there was Van Mariani, which was a coca leaf wine. And all of these things were stimulants. You know, and then the opposite side of the coin was the laudanum and the opiated syrup, and nothing was regulated.
Yeah, so you can see where it wasn't just trying to control for the sake of making money.
Yeah.
They were really thinking about the public good.
But it did evolve it was really the drug war really started at that time too, and it grew. Through, you know, the decades of the 20th century till it reached a place where it was, you know, a weapon of the government, and it was just an automatic rejection of anything that, you know, gave people, you know, and okay, there were always the drugs that were dangerous and you know, addictive, but it was not only those drugs, as we well know, but, you know, drugs that were, you might say, recreational and others that opened the doors to the divinity that
right.
were, you know, lumped in. They were all lumped together.
Right, right.
I mean, right
they
today.
Were all equally.
And, right. And psychedelic drugs were first, you know, first some of the first usage of it was with people who were dying. And now that has become more acceptable. But in those days, you know, there was very little hospice recognition or thought of the
possibility. So in other words, like using morphine to ease ease pain or
yes.
Well, you know, we're starting to run out of time, so let me just sort of punctuate a couple things. I was really interested in Mary Mosaic. She was associated with John Kennedy, and then she was assassinated.
Right.
Can you?
This has been rumored for about 20 or 30 years, but a book came out just a year ago called Mary's Mosaic. Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Meyer, and the Vision of World Peace. This is a very interesting, this is an LSD story, really. She was one of John Kennedy's lovers. He had a number, but she was closer to him than any of the others, and possibly by then closer to him than his wife. And she introduced him to... It's definite that she introduced them to cannabis, marijuana, and that they smoked in the White House. She also, there is evidence emerged that they also took a mild LSD trip in the White House. She and a group of women. She was very sophisticated, but she was from the same social set as the Kennedys, and those people were. Frequently, they were among the earliest people. There you go. The ultra rich and the well to do were among the early experimenters. They and the literary people like the Huxleys and Anais Nin. But getting back to Mary Meyer, she and a group of women in 1962 were meeting and taking LSD together in a group, and many of them were connected to some of the most important men in Washington, some of the most powerful people. In her case, it was the President of the United States. And she went to Timothy Leary to ask him how to guide an LSD trip. But she wouldn't tell him of course, the person she had in mind. And he gave her all the information he could, but he never knew who it was. Well, it's, a blanket of disinformation here, but Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was previously married to a CIA officer, was assassinated 4 months after John F. Kennedy in May 1964. And her assassination, the book that came out called Mary's Mosaic, as I referred to earlier, makes the case through very well, actually, that the CIA was involved in both those assassinations. But the reason behind it is what interests us the most is that the vision of world peace, that the psychedelic drugs like LSD and mescaline and psilocybin mushrooms can give a vision to people that way beyond, the material world that we live in, and certainly way beyond, the paranoia or fear that generates war and suppression and so on, and that she was turning him toward a vision of peace, and may have taken him away. He was, he's very he questioned the CIA, and he may have ended the war in Vietnam well before it got underway.
So that's really dangerous for the bloated military-industrial complex, isn't
boy,
it?
Boy, is it ever. Yeah.
Or Fox News, who thrives on fear-mongering.
Yes.
I mean, it's
yes.
Like I said before, it's really interesting to connect all of these dots, isn't it?
Isn't it?
You see one thing is connected to another. Wow. I want to thank you guys for this book. This is a beautiful book. Thank you so much for sending it to me.
Thank you, Karen, for having us on.
I can't wait to read it from cover to cover. Just very quickly, because I only have like a minute or two left, one of the names that surprised me the most was Maya Angelou. Is there a quick story for her that she's in the book?
Yes. She used cannabis, marijuana, when she was a young woman. And she was in an abusive relationship with a man, and she wrote about that. She wrote many volumes of autobiography. I think this was the Cage Bird Things. She by smoking marijuana. You know, she got to see the abusive relationship she was in, and it gave her the courage to leave it.
Wow.
So that was a beautiful story. I did want to mention that the book is available. It's still in print. This is of the extreme. And, you know, your listeners could find it on Amazon.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, what are you working on now? Anything new or, what would you like listeners to know?
What are we working on now? Oh, boy. We're retired now. Do we have a project right now? we're going to keep up with this because we haven't really gone as far with this as we'd like to.
We haven't kept in touch with it either, which would be, I mean, we're always clipping articles and gathering material. Thinking, oh, well, we can write about another decade now.
But we're in the new millennium, is the 2000s. It's quite bizarre out there, and you know, drugs are available on the internet, and there was the ecstasy. We should mention, you know, women were very much participated in both the 60s counterculture and onward through the ecstasy generation, you might call it, the 1990s. And, of course, that was also the male-dominant culture came down on that one as well, it seems like. But, you know, the question is, will drugs make those inroads into the people who call the shots? Could that actually change? You know, we think it can. But, of course, they don't want it to because it doesn't enrich them, particularly in material wealth.
The people in control, it doesn't further their agenda. It just, stops people from being sheeple, basically.
That's right, yeah.
Well, guys, listen, keep in touch with me. If you have an angle for another show, we will do one. I'm sure there's lots we didn't have a chance to touch on tonight because I really like how we connect all of the dots here. And
great.
We didn't even talk about Sappho's Ambrosia. So
oh, my God,
have to
no.
Come back
there's
on
a,
the show.
There's so many stories.
It's an eight-line poem, but what was ambrosia? You know, it was probably opium and cannabis, you know, together or something, you know, more psychoactive.
So it wasn't really some sort of a fruit. It wasn't a fruit cocktail then.
It was
then.
Nectar of the gods.
Nectar of the gods.
Yeah, the food of the gods.
But a little
and
different
that
than
means,
what
that
the recipe book said.
Psychoactive, yeah.
Well, you know what? It has been so much fun. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure for us as well.
Keep in touch with me. Keep in touch with me. And listeners, go to Amazon. It is Sisters of the Extreme by Cynthia Palmer and Michael Horowitz. I'm looking at the book. It's gorgeous. You will love it. Thank you both so much. I'm so sorry I'm running out of time.
You're welcome.
Okay. Good night, Karen.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Well, listeners, I'm sure you enjoyed that. I know I sure did. And we will have them back, I promise. Just a few last-minute things before we go off the air here tonight. Thanks for staying with me for this last bit of sharing. I asked last week for a favor of listeners, but I'll ask again and maybe continue to do so for a time until I feel I've gotten the word out. I'm really trying to sell out my remaining copies of Sacred Places of Goddess so my publisher and I can go on and do separate things. If you're thinking about a gift for yourself or a friend or would like a one-of-a-kind book in your library that tells about ancient living traditions of Goddess and her sacred sites around the world, help you and help me by selling out the remaining copies, and you get a wonderful book in your library. Purchase them from any local bookseller or, better yet, directly from me on my website, KarenTate.com. I have a Goddess store page where I sell the books at a better price than you can get them new from the online sellers. Or make a donation, and if you say it's a book to go to a worthy cause, tell me what it is, and I'll send it to that worthy cause in your name. Thanks for letting me put that out there. And you know what? If you'd like to buy a big quantity for a fundraiser, we might even be able to give you a deep discount. Don't forget, I want you to think about this. Are you letting loose your sacred roar and emailing and writing and calling the White House and your representatives and senators in Congress demanding that there be no change CPI, which are cuts to Social Security? Please do, because seniors are already living in poverty. It's immoral to cut their benefits so the richest corporations and the 1% can continue getting their corporate welfare and their tax loopholes and breaks while the rest of us suffer. Also, I'd love to meet you if you're in Southern California area. I will have a booth and be on a panel in the Health Hut for an event out here called World Fest on May 19th in the San Fernando Valley. You can hear me talking about goddess ideals for a sustainable future. And in June, I'll be at the Long Beach Women's Spirit Fair with a booth. I hope you'll come by and say hello. As we come to the closing of tonight's show, I want you to remember something very important, lest we never forget. Adversaries of the sacred feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time, and with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, disrespected, all of that stuff. That's why here on the show, I'm sure you are right there with me. I am dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to taste those mushrooms, to open ourselves to altered states, carefully, of course, to be powerful and uppity women and men, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so we know why things are the way they are. Isn't it interesting to connect the dots on so many things like we did tonight? We want to know how things have come to be so turned on their head and so unnatural, and we are going about setting things right, because if we want to save ourselves and Mother Earth, our beloved Gaia, then we have no other choice. If we want to live in a world of balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, equity, fairness, partnership, it is women and our like-minded brothers, armed with ideals of the sacred feminine, who will set things back on course. I gave you one of the mottos of the show earlier on. It was a motto of Gandhi. Here's one by the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. I think it pertains as well. He said, all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. Please remember to check out my website. I'm available to come give a talk to your group or teach a weekend workshop. There's also lots of free stuff there at www.karentate.com, meditations you can download, classes on my YouTube channel, articles, and great resources. Look at my two books. Check out the goddess greeting cards. I also make sacred rattles of the Egyptian goddesses called Sistra. We have them available as well. Finally, remember what Mother Nature teaches us, what you nurture and tend to survives and thrives, and what we neglect withers, and that goes for everything and every facet of your life. So please send a donation to help keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air. So good night, my dear listeners, friends, fans, family, colleagues. May Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. And in this these last few minutes, I will let you hear a little bit of Celia's cut, Everyday Goddess.
It's really no big deal, I'm just an everyday goddess, doing all my goddess duties, trying to find a way. I am the maiden and the mother and the clone, but it's really no big deal, it's just another day. Here's a goddess in a skirt, lonely legs, she can drop you to your knees and make you. Queen.